This meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1 p.m. on Wednesday, April 15th, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Eichheit, Representative Vance, Representative Costello, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting: Sophia Tenney from House Records, Kyla Tupo from the Juno LIO, and my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez. We have five items of business on today's agenda: SJR2, constitutional amendment, votes needed for veto override; HJR31, constitutional amendment, corporations and rights; HB157, effective adoption decree on siblings; HJR28, Support Kids Online Safety Act; and HB74, crime counterfeit non-functioning airbag. Our first item of business is SJR2, constitutional amendment, votes needed for veto override. For its first hearing in our committee, I will note for the record that we were joined by Representative Underwood at 1:01 p.m. At this time, I would like to invite the sponsor, Senator Klayman, and his staff, Carly Dennis, to the witness table. Please put yourself on the record and begin. But before I do that, we are joined by Representative Mina and Representative Kopp at 1:01 p.m.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, I'm Matt Klayman, State Senator from Senate District H in West Anchorage. Thank you for hearing Senate Joint Resolution 2 today. Senate Joint Resolution 2 proposes an important change to our state constitution to improve the public's ability to influence the executive and legislative decisions on revenue and appropriations matters. It would ask Alaska voters to amend Article 2, Section 16 of our Constitution to lower the override requirement for revenue and appropriations vetoes from the three-fourths of the legislature sitting in joint session, or 45 votes, to two-thirds, or 40 votes. In recent years, former legislators John Coghill and Jonathan Kreis Tompkins have both introduced an identical resolution to the body. Alaska has the highest requirement for overriding a revenue or appropriation veto of any state. Only one other state, Arizona, comes close to this high override threshold. The other 40, and they only do it for revenue matters, not on appropriation matters. The other 48 states all have lower override requirements for revenue and appropriations matters. Most states require a two-thirds vote for both legislative chambers to override a gubernatorial veto. Seven states require a three-fifths vote, and six states only require a simple majority to override a governor's veto. Few states differentiate between vetoed revenue and appropriations items and typical policy bills. The three-quarter vote requirement makes it extremely difficult for the legislature to override a revenue or appropriations veto. Since statehood, the legislature has only overridden appropriations vetoes five times and only twice since 1987. The three-quarter requirement also creates a difficult double standard for revenue and appropriations legislature to pass the governor. A typical policy bill, although it might contain a fiscal note, requires a two-thirds vote to override if it receives a governor's veto. If that override succeeds, the governor may then use his line item veto to remove funding for the bill from the budget. That line item veto then requires a three-quarter vote to pass. And we saw this dynamic unfold last year when the governor vetoed House Bill 57 in May. The legislature overrode that vote, or that veto, with the two-thirds override. And then the governor vetoed the House Bill 57 education funding from the budget, and we needed 45 votes to override that veto. Lowering the revenue and appropriations requirement to two-thirds will align the requirements for all vetoed legislation and eliminate this double standard. In crafting Alaska's constitution, Alaska's framers established a strong governor form of government. This structure is evident when looking at the three-quarter legislative vote requirement to override fiscal legislation and the governor's right to select the attorney general. When Alaska was a young state, the idea of a strong governor made sense. Today, I'd like to say we are still young, but we really are much more middle-aged. Our economy has grown, and public participation in the political process has increased substantially. This amendment returns more power to all Alaskans and their elected representatives and senators, and it will establish a better balance between the governor and the legislature. If two-thirds of the House and Senate both approve SJR2, it will appear on the November ballot. And in the end, it is not our decision, it's the voters' decisions. And the question about putting it on the ballot is not subject to a governor's veto. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Ms. Dennis, would you like to walk us through the sectional?
Yes. To the chair, this is Carly Dennis, staff to Senator Klayman. There's just two sections of Senate Joint Resolution 2. Section 1 deletes the three-quarters vote requirement to override vetoes for revenue and appropriations bills and changes that to a two-thirds vote. And Section 2 would put the amendment proposed by this resolution on the ballot in the next general election for Alaskans to consider.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee for Senator Klayman or his staff? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question that I have is not on the changes, but there's been some, for lack of a better word, confusion about some vagueness on if a, you know, the a time that a veto override could happen. And I think on page 1, line 16, no later than the fifth day of the special session of the legislature, if one is called. Did you have any thoughts or discussion about clarifying that so that legislatures are sure as to what action needs to be taken? I know there's always conversation about that, and wondered if you have addressed that in prior committees.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that is a topic that has had a lot of discussion, and the prior committees, there's been no suggestion that we should add that topic to this proposed constitutional amendment. I would say that that's actually an area upon which, in communication with Legislative Legal Services, they took kind of what I thought was an interesting perspective. I think the constitutional language is pretty plain that when we come back, whether it be in special session or regular session, not after we've adjourned sine die, but when we came back this year in January, that I think the language is pretty straightforward that we need to meet in joint session. We might choose to adjourn out very quickly and not take up any votes, but I think the language is fairly plain. And so I know there's been some debate, but I actually think the constitutional language is pretty straightforward.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Costello.
Thank you. And you had mentioned that Senator Coghill and Representative Christ Tompkins had introduced similar measures. Can you tell the committee why it is that you think that they didn't make it out of the process?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, I actually have spoken a couple of times with now former Senator Coghill. He was very supportive, and I didn't ask him, what happened when you introduced it? Did it get very far? Did it not get very far? We didn't have that conversation, and I had a similar conversation with former Representative Christ Tompkins, who said largely the same thing. It's a good idea, and I didn't get to the question about kind of what was the dynamic when you introduced it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Kopp.
I appreciate you bringing this forward, Senator Klayman. I think it's a really important policy discussion. And, you know, I can imagine that, you know, from a political party perspective to, you know, maybe answer Senator Costello, Representative Costello's question, it puts you at odds at times on a party basis. So it's my guess is that's probably why this has had a hard time. But just as a policy call, I think you're absolutely doing the right thing, taking all the politics out of it, whatever party holds the governor's office, I think, trying to get it so that the veto process and the outcome is better reflective of where the people of Alaska are at is very important. The other thing that I think is I didn't hear you mention this, but I think it's really important for relationship building. A 45 veto threshold doesn't require you to build any relationships with hardly anybody. A 40 requires you to engage. And I think that's good for the political process. And I'm not saying that to be critical of we've had a number of past executives that have more or less degrees of success with that. But I think your bill drives at the necessity of the strength of that and putting effort into that to have a policy stick or not. So that's where I'm at on it, and I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I will just, on a fairly simple level, I completely agree with that it encourages the executive to be more engaged with the legislature, and I think that would be true and it would have been true since statehood. And I note we actually haven't overridden the legislature, even if you look at total vetoes. I think the total number of overrides, if it's 5 fiscal vetoes, it's around 45 right. other vetoes. It's not very many, and the reason is that an engaged executive, it's pretty hard to override an engaged executive, whether it's 2/3 or 3/4.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll just say that the two governors that were most that had the most overrides were Tony Knowles with, I think, 20, and Governor Hammond with 16. It's quite a lot. So kind of interesting that those were the two that with the most vetoes. Seeing no further questions, I would like to turn to invited testimony at this time. Our invited testifier is Bruce Botello, former Attorney General for the state of Alaska. Mr. Botello, would you please come to the front, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Botello. I reside in Juneau, Alaska, and as Mr. Chair, you've outlined, my background and basis for testifying today is largely a result of my experience as State Attorney General and having spent a substantial part of my time being a student of the Alaska Constitution. What I'd like to do is give maybe a little history lesson, if that's all right, because I think it helps illuminate the discussion on the proposed resolution here. The power of the executive veto actually arises in the Roman Republic, but in terms of Anglo-American law, it traces its roots to the power of royally appointed governors and the monarchy itself to veto any actions of colonial legislators. That power was actually one of the specific grievances in the Declaration of Independence. In the post-colonial period, the right of the executive to veto legislation was retained, but every new state constitution embodied what is reflected in our own, and that is the power of the legislature to override a veto. All 50 states incorporate that power. And the veto process serves the twin goals of allowing the executive an opportunity to consider bills passed by the legislature and allowing the legislature an opportunity to consider any of the executive's objections and, in some cases, to override his veto. This give and take between the legislative and executive branches comprises an important part of the checks and balances system of the American constitutional tradition. So 70 years ago, actually, on February 6, 1956, our Alaska constitutional framers adjourned, having adopted its veto override provision requiring a 2/3 vote for all veto legislation except appropriation bills, which requires a 3/4 vote. The reasoning reflected in the debates over the veto override provision, especially with respect to appropriations measures, was that Alaska needed a strong executive. This philosophy was mirrored in several provisions of the Constitution, and today would be popularly referred to as the unitary executive. Thus, we have the consolidation of departments under a single executive. We have the line item veto as two examples of that consolidated power. But the question comes up, why the 3/4 vote specifically? It doesn't come from our territorial experience. The Organic Act of 1912 provided veto overrides at 2/3 of each house, voting separately. what's interesting is the actual first record that I could find of a veto override involved a veto of a women's working hours law enacted by the legislature in 1915. Governor Strong vetoed that measure, and it was overridden. In fact, the only reference I can find anywhere in looking at the 3/4 vote is that Alexander Hamilton at the Constitutional Convention proposed a 3/4 vote. and it was rejected resoundingly by the Constitutional Convention. And though the proceedings of our own convention make no specific mention of it, I think one of the things that actually may have motivated the higher threshold happened in a controversy that occurred during the 1953 legislature. A major dispute between the governor and legislature happening 2 years before the convention convened itself. In 1953, the new legislative majority moved to repeal the general property tax that Governor Ernest Greening had championed as the cornerstone of a comprehensive tax system. He vetoed the repeal bill in an effort to preserve that tax structure. And the legislature promptly moved to override its veto. And the House did so on a vote of 20-4. And the Senate followed with an 11-4 vote, satisfying the override rule, and in fact would have satisfied the three-quarter vote in that circumstance. When it came to the convention itself and the debate on the floor, which primarily took place in January of 1956, the person championing the two-thirds vote on appropriations was Delegate George Sundberg. Sundberg had come to Alaska as a political reporter for the Alaska Daily Empire and made the following argument in favor of the two-thirds majority, and I'm just going to read it. "Mr. President, as the proposal has been reported to us by the committee, it sets up two classes of legislation, one of which requires a two-thirds vote of the legislature to override a veto by the governor, and another class which requires a three-quarters vote of the legislature to override the veto. My observation of legislators, not only of the Alaska legislature, and I think of every session since the 1939 session, and of several other legislatures in action, is that it is very rare that any bill, that the veto is overridden by the legislature anyway, and to make it necessary that a three-quarters vote of the legislature be obtained on certain classes of legislation would, I think, ensure that those classes of legislation, once vetoed, would never be overridden by the body. So I think we ought to stick to the uniform rule that makes it a two-thirds vote." Stan McCutcheon, who was an Anchorage attorney, championed the three-quarter vote, and it's his viewpoint is the one that prevailed, of course. He says, "We feel that in supporting a strong executive arm, it should require a greater number than two-thirds of the total number of legislators to override the governor's veto on a matter of budget, because you cannot exercise a strong executive arm unless you have a strong control on the purse strings." So that brings us to the question, why reduce the requirements from three-quarters to a two-thirds majority? I think there are four reasons. I would start off first, it aligns with other vetoes and with other states. A two-thirds vote is already the standard to override all non-appropriation vetoes in Alaska. Budget vetoes alone require the three-quarters. It is inconsistent, and I think hard to justify that a single bill, the budget, requires a significantly higher override margin than any other policy bill. And as Senator Klayman pointed out, Alaska is the only state that requires a three-quarter vote to override appropriations vetoes. While most states require two-thirds, 36 states to be exact, 7 states require a three-fifths vote, and 6 states require a majority vote. The second argument that I would make in favor of the reduction is in terms of balance of powers and checks on the governor. The current three-quarter requirement, combined with the governor's line item veto and the power of reduction, gives the executive unusually strong leverage over the budget process compared with other states. This weakens the legislature's role as a co-equal branch and diminishes its ability to check partisan or policy-driven vetoes that do not reflect broad legislative consensus. The third, and these are all obviously closely related, and that is protecting the legislature's core constitutional duty. And passing a budget is the one action the legislature is constitutionally required to undertake each year. So the override rule should not make that duty nearly impossible to defend against unilateral cuts. The higher threshold allows a relatively small minority aligned with the governor to block restoration of funding, even when a large bipartisan majority wants those appropriations. And finally, I would argue that making this reduction is responsive to voters and public services. When vetoes cut widely supported items like school funding, local services, or capital projects, the three-quarters requirement makes it hard for legislators to respond to their constituents' preferences. Rare or failed budget veto overrides, despite strong legislative support for restoring funds, show the current rule can undercut democratic accountability for core public services. I return to Delegate George Sundberg's prediction that appropriation bills, once vetoed, would never be overridden. I think the fact is that, with extremely rare exception, he's been proven to be right. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Botello. Are there questions for Mr. Botello from committee? Representative Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Botello, for being here today. It's good to see you. I am aware that Alaska's constitution is heralded as one of the better, if not the best, state constitution in our country. And so I was curious your comments on that. And I hear that one of the reasons is that it does have a strong executive, with the line item that you mentioned, and then the different threshold for the bills with the fiscal impact or budget bills. And if you could comment on that. And then secondly, if it is true that this power is, you know, tipped in the scale of the executive to the detriment of the legislative body, why haven't we seen more bills in our history to actually accomplish what this measure does? So apparently this is the third total out of our entire state history. Could you comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, I would observe, and I share Representative Costello's observation about the Constitution being one of the best. My own bias is to say that it is the best. And I rely primarily not only on my own view of it, but scholars who have looked at our Constitution and have noted the economy of words in the document, that its flexibility in terms of allowing the legislature to implement general policies. It's been particularly highlighted in terms of its preeminence in placing rights and responsibilities as Article 1 of the Constitution. It is the first constitution to have Article 8, a natural resources article, which calls for maximizing development to the benefit of this and future generations. Again, one can go through virtually every article and find elements. I don't think the three-quarter vote is one that's been particularly highlighted. What is noted is that the fact that the vote is done in joint session, and the fact that cabinet officers and other state officials are confirmed in joint session, is a nod to one of the early discussions about whether Alaska should have a unicameral legislature or a bicameral legislature. And so certain elements of the unicameral system were actually incorporated into the Constitution. That is unique among our Constitution. So those would be the general comments. As to why this issue of veto override has not arisen, I think it actually has, more than the two instances over time. But it has, and I think it is a reflection in part of, I would call it partisan politics, whether you have a Democratic majority or a Republican majority, that the minority sees this as an opportunity to be a check on the majority. And that philosophy has carried the day, I think, in the past. Those would be my observations.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you brought up the unicameral legislature, and I know that's not in here, but what is your opinion on whether or not Alaska would benefit by a unicameral versus bicameral legislature?
My view, Mr. Chairman, is that the bicameral system, as cumbersome as it may be at times, we have been blessed by the fact that the failure of a piece of legislation making it through one body but not the other has been, for the most part, an important check on legislation. And so my overall view is that our bicameral system is healthy for democracy, that it's important to have those kinds of checks, not only between the executive and the legislature, but between the legislative bodies.
Thank you. And thank you for your indulgence on my questioning.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Costello. I have a question sort of stemming off of Representative Costello's line of questioning, and that's about the history. Back at the Constitutional Convention, when you mentioned that Mr. McCutcheon, the attorney from Anchorage, was the person championing the three-quarter vote override, and George Sundberg?
Sundberg, yes.
The reporter was advocating for keeping it universally two-thirds.
That's correct.
Was that close, or was there a massive amount of support for McCutcheon over Sandberg's idea?
My recollection is that the vote ended up being probably in the area of a two-thirds, one-third vote on that as well. It was perhaps not quite that. But it was a prevailing view, and it certainly was a view of the committee which proposed it.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Botello? Thank you so much for your testimony today. We will now set SJR2 aside and bring it back up at a later date. Thank you to Senator Klayman and his staff for presenting the bill today. Our second item of business is HJR 31, Constitutional Amendment, Corporations and Rights, sponsored by Representative Fields. At this time, I will call an at-ease. Back on the record, we are now joined by Representative Fields and his staff, Michael Noddy. Representative Fields, do you have any additional comments on the resolution before we take up amendments?
No.
Thank you, Representative Fields. As a reminder, we left two amendments on the table at the last hearing. Neither had been adopted. At this time, I will move Amendment 1.
At ease.
At ease. Back on the record, is there any objection?
I object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you. So Amendment 1 removes the specific campaign finance provisions of the resolution while preserving the language that clarifies inherent constitutional rights belong only to natural persons. I would like to ask the sponsor whether he has a position on Amendment number 1.
I support the amendment.
Are there any questions about Amendment 1? Do you maintain your objection?
I do not.
Seeing no other objections, Amendment 1 has been adopted. We will now turn to Amendment 2. Representative Vance, do you still plan to move Amendment 2?
Mr. Chairman, I do not plan to move Amendment 2 in light of the conversation that I had with your staff and looking at this and the conversations around the purpose of the Constitution as a framework, and felt that Amendment number 2 that was specific to adding artificial intelligence may not be appropriate because it is a very quickly evolving construct. And by clarifying that natural persons that are not artificial intelligence, I think fits what we want to keep the Constitution clear. But I just want to put for the record that it is my intent that natural persons does not include artificial intelligence because it is man-made. Natural persons are clearly people who have a conscience and can discern right and wrong. And we're seeing the artificial intelligence, although it is becoming autonomous, is clearly a man-made function that we do not want to have the same constitutional rights. And I think that this committee has been very clear on that. So I will not be offering Amendment number 2 just to keep with the intent of natural persons being simply that.
Thank you, Representative Vance, and I appreciate your comments. Representative Fields.
I agree. I think it should be abundantly clear from the committee discussion that natural persons does not include AI. So I agree with Representative Vance.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Do you have any final comments about HJR 31?
Thank you for the committee's time to examine it.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from committee members? Can I have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, at this time, I move that House Joint Resolution 31 Work Order 34-LS1226/A as amended be reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, House Joint Resolution 31 Work Order 34-LS1226/A is an alpha. As amended, is reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. I authorize Legislative Legal Services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. We will take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. At ease. back on the record. We are moving on to our next item of business, which is to bring up House Bill 157, Effect of Adoption Decree on Siblings, up for its first hearing in this committee. This bill is sponsored by me, Representative Gray. I will want to say for the record that this bill was supposed to be heard on Monday. Our invited testifiers are unable to be here today. So we will be introducing the bill, doing public testimony, but our invited testifiers, one of whom is a retired attorney who can answer many of the questions of this committee, will be back for the next time that we hear the bill. So just throwing that out there that we may not be able to answer all of your questions today, but we will be able to at some point. I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Kopp and move to the front.
Okay, committee, Representative Gray, thank you. You may introduce yourself for the record before proceeding with rollout of the bill and also introduce your team member or have them introduce themselves. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. For the record, Andrew Gray, representative for House District 20, the UMed District in Anchorage, and I'm with my staff, Rosie Coette. You can say it.
For the record, Rosie Coette, staff to Rep. Gray.
Thank you for hearing House Bill 157. Sibling relationships are among the most powerful and enduring connections a person can have. They last longer than the relationship that you have with your parents, the relationship that you have with your children, the relationship that you have with your spouse. Your siblings are with you from the very beginning till the very end. For children in foster care, siblings are often a remaining link to their past, their identity, and their family. These bonds provide emotional stability, comfort, and a sense of belonging during an experience that is often confusing and traumatic. American Academy of Pediatrics notes that family separation, quote, can cause irreparable harm, disrupting a child's brain architecture and affecting his or her short and long-term health, end quote. When siblings are placed apart in foster care, many never receive regular visits or contact with one another. Siblings who maintain contact experience greater feelings of safety, fewer emotional and behavioral challenges, stronger peer relationships, and better school performance. Under current Alaska law, adoption ends the legal relationship between adopted children and their birth family, including siblings. HB 157 preserves legal sibling relationships and encourages adoptive families to maintain these vital connections. Thank you for hearing House Bill 157 today.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Ms. Quip, will you walk us through the section?
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kopp and members of the committee. For the record, Rosie Coette, staff to Rep. Gray. I will now walk us through the sectional analysis. Section 1 clarifies that the legal relationship between an adopted person and that person's siblings is not terminated as a result of an adoption decree. Section 2 requires the court to determine whether post-adoption visitation with a foster child sibling is in the child's best interest and to document that determination in the final adoption decree. Section 3 clarifies that when an adoption decree terminates the legal relationship between an adopted person and the person's biological parents or relatives, the decree does not terminate the legal relationship between the adopted person and the person's siblings. Section 4 defines a sibling as a person who, 1, is related to an individual by blood, adoption, or marriage as a child of one or both parents, or 2, was raised together with an individual in the same household for a period of time and in the same manner as children related by blood, adoption, or marriage. Section 5 provides that the act takes effect immediately. Thank you.
Okay. Committee members, any questions for Ms. Coette or Representative Gray? Representative Underwood.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. I'm just curious, how many states, when a child gets adopted, do their legal rights get cut off? Just curiosity.
Through the chair to Representative Underwood, all of them.
Really? Interesting.
I just find that amazing. Okay, Representative Mead.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. Through the Vice Chair, we heard this bill in the Health and Social Services Committee, and I wanted to follow up on some of the questions that I asked there that are very legal in nature, given the matter of the adoption and the court proceedings. The two of the different topics that I brought up, one was related to the confidentiality of the adoption decree, and the second was related to the definition of siblings. So I first wanted to ask, do you still have interest in having this bill also loosen up some of the confidentiality of the adoption decree? Because right now, only the new adoptive parents are able to know the personal information related to the adoptee, but not the sibling.
Through Vice Chair Kopp to Representative Mina, can you restate the question?
Yes, through the Vice Chair to Representative Gray. When we heard a lot of the testimony in Health and Social Services, many of the testifiers talked about how once their sibling, their biological sibling, is adopted, they don't know where they are. Mm-hmm. They don't know any information about them. Have you considered looking into the confidentiality statute and incorporating that into this bill as well?
Thank you for the question. Yes, we have. I think I'll just say for the committee, for the vice chair, that this, the genesis of this bill and the really the goal from my perspective was that we have lots of examples of large sibling groups that get separated by this process. And we didn't want to impose another mandate on OCS. We did not want to give them extra work. You know, once a child is adopted, in many ways, OCS sort of sees their job as being done. And so we don't want to add burdens on them that continue on into the future. What we wanted was to acknowledge at that adoption proceeding, we wanted the court to say on the record, this child has existing sibling relationships that we believe would be in the best interest of the child to maintain, mm-hmm. and not to tell the adopted family how they would go about maintaining it. I guess it's not really answering Representative Mina's question. I can speak as the parent of a foster child who we adopted, that he does have a sibling on the East Coast. We do maintain contact, but it's very much and I think because of the nature of foster children being adopted, that's always an open adoption. So there's always, you know, you've done a ton of mommy meetings, daddy meetings, grandparent meetings. You've met that birth family. So the bottom line is that I think in most cases, and I'm happy, I don't know if any OCS folks are online, but or they're present. Most of the time, the adopted parent knows about the existing siblings and knows where they are or knows where they might end up. And so we really just wanted to have an official recognition and encouragement of maintaining that bond. If there's a need, I guess, like, I'm still trying to wrap my head around about how we would change confidentiality language to allow, you know, an 8-year-old to have access to confidential. I have to think more about how that would play out and what that would look like. Obviously, we want to make it possible for siblings to maintain relationships, but I don't know that statute well enough. And when we have invited testimony, the attorney would be able to speak to what currently happens and what's currently protected.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Representative May, any follow up?
I'll hold for now. Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Committee members, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the fiscal note from the courts, from the Alaska court system. I think it offers some answers to Rep. Mina's questions, not specific about confidentiality, but it says on page 2, implementing House Bill 157 would require first an identification of who fits the definition of sibling for all adoptees. Then, if the adoptee is a minor in state custody, the court would need to determine whether contact with those identified siblings is in the adoptee's best interest. That determination must be included in the adoption decree. Finally, the court would potentially determine whether the adoption decree should also post-adoption visitation, would allow post-adoption visitation with each sibling, and if so, to what extent. So the way I see that this bill is kind of that first step, and in my, I mean, bill sponsor obviously has a lot more experience in this, but is the question to you, Rep. Gray, is this what you're wanting, is that the courts are able to take a look and say, hey, this is clearly in their best interest, these are qualified, and really we do our part by passing this bill to allow this to happen and then put it into the hands of the courts that can really look at the full picture of that individual child being adopted. And then later, if the court needs more clarification in statute, they come back to us. Is that kind of what you're hoping will take place?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, I have to admit that I think I was a little bit naive about thinking how limited my bill was when I read this fiscal note, because I actually didn't want to create additional hearings to decide whether or not it was in the best interest of the child to keep contact with siblings. I actually wanted to put that in the hands of the adoptive parent. I wanted the adoptive parent to have that freedom. And by the way, I think we're going to hear in public testimony, there are probably some foster kids out there who've been adopted who really wouldn't want they just want to have the contact with their siblings, and they don't want the court to decide it, or, you know, their adoptive parent to decide it. They want to keep that contact. But I had envisioned this as really just putting it on the record. The child has existing sibling relationships that would be in the best interest for the child to maintain. So I'm in conversation with the courts about this issue, and, I think Representative Mina, as chair of Health and Social Services, during our hearings there, it's quite clear that we're going to need to do some amendments to this bill to make sure that we're not creating additional hearings, that we're not creating additional burdens. But I think it's in the best interest of the bill to hold off until we have the invited testimony.
Representative Vance.
One more follow-up. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Gray. I think I agree with you, but the one caveat is the child in need of aid cases where there may be family relationships that are not beneficial mm-hmm. at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
But we want them, when they become adults, to be able to have the liberty to have contact with their siblings if they so choose to, right? Because we hope that time will heal wounds and that people will improve. Mm-hmm. We want those family relationships. So that would be the where I would like more insight is mm-hmm. is from their perspective of what they've seen and what they feel is needed, so that we're not too broad but not too narrow on requiring more bureaucracy. Because I agree with you, we want this to be more familial. So I look forward to the testimony that you have and finding out what other agencies are saying based upon the history of what they've seen that children are dealing with right now.
Thank you. I have a comment on that through the chair to Representative Vance. I think that's kind of hearkening back to Representative Mina's question about confidentiality. Because obviously once folks are adults, you know, they can decide who they contact. And I think the fear is like, well, what if the child gets adopted, has a different last name, and you don't know how to find your sibling if you don't know their last name? You know, you got adopted, they were in the foster system, they got adopted at a later time, and maybe you don't know what their last name is. But again, and I don't know, can you speak to this, Chrissy? I mean, about the number of, it just, in my experience, most of them know where their siblings are. Most of them know how to find their siblings. So I think the scenario in which that the sibling has been completely lost once they reach adulthood is very low.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Underwood.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. Just for my clarification on this, this just means, and tell me if I'm wrong or not, but that they're just not legally separated from their, as in like they're still siblings legally, period. Like no matter what else happens, if they contact them, if they don't contact them, at the end of the day, this just means they have legal siblings, whether they want to pursue that relationship or not. This bill doesn't dictate any of that, correct? This is just saying we are legally siblings forever and we can either have a relationship or not have a relationship.
Through the chair, that is correct, Representative Underwood. I think there's probably a reason why all 50 states haven't done this, and that's because we've learned this from previous hearings. If they're legally siblings, then there's inheritance. There are other things that could happen that no matter how much we don't want to put a burden on OCS or whatever, there might be unintended consequences, which is why we are having this hearing right now.
And through the chair, the unintended consequence would be they could potentially have an inheritance from
parents. Again, through the chair, I, you know, this is something that's come up, and I believe the circumstances in which siblings separated in the foster system remain legal siblings and get adopted into separate families, and then, you know, something happens and there's an inheritance. I think it's incredibly unlikely. So I find that hypothetical extremely hard to think is something that's going to happen. However, that's what lawyers do, and it could be a potential issue. And also, I say this because it came up, and is Carla Erickson online? Because so she's the attorney for OCS. What came up in a previous hearing, if they remain legal siblings, and say, for example, a child is adopted, their sibling remains in foster care. The parents of the legal sibling would become a preferred placement for that foster child. They would be the equivalent of a grandparent in terms of OCS needing to find homes. I personally think this is a positive unintended consequence. But again, it's changing the way OCS works. It would change their process, and that has an impact, you know, having to do a new way of placing kids. Of course, again, I play it out in my head. You try to keep foster kids together when you initially place them. There was a reason why the foster, I don't know if it was a sibling group of five and this family was willing to take three. There's a reason why those other two weren't placed there. I think reaching out and asking them, could you take the other two? I don't think that's an enormous burden, and I think it might be in the best interest of the kids. So I play it out that I'm not sure that it's as big of an impact as some folks might think, but it would have an impact on the way kids are placed.
Thank you for your indulgence on the back and forth. But I do tend to agree with what you're saying, and sometimes we do need change for good things to happen. So thanks for bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay,
I have a question.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. Through the Vice Chair, so I'm hearing of different goals for the bill, especially we've learned more about different legal ramifications as we've had hearings on this. So I'm trying to figure out what is that top goal. Is it to have siblings who are separated because of adoption still be siblings legally? Is it having these siblings who are separated be able to contact each other? Because we've heard of so many cases where siblings are separated. And or is it having also that new adoptive family be that preferred placement for the siblings? What's the most important thing?
Thank you. Through the chair, the most important thing, and this bill came from former foster kids, so was to recognize that these sibling relationships exist and to somehow codify them. And if when we had the hearing here, Angel Gonzalez was the testifier who talked about, and she will be invited testimony next time, but she talked about how she was adopted a separate family from her brother, and about a conversation that they had where she said that he said, you know, you're not even my sister anymore. Like acknowledging that that they are no longer legal siblings and what that felt like for her. And I think some of this stems from them just feeling like that even though they are blood siblings, that this law is not, that it actually has an impact on the way they think about their relationships. Like it does have a meaning beyond just simplifying an adoption process. And so I think it really is to correct something that they feel like is a wrong that's being done to them, that they're having this important relationship severed. I think that's what it is. It is to correct a wrong. And the wrong is that this most important relationship in someone's life is being legally terminated by an adoption. And it's to preserve that important legal relationship.
Follow up?
Yes, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. Through the Vice Chair, I know we talked about this in the last committee, especially with Ms. Erickson, about what it means to be a sibling legally. And I think when we have all of the individuals available for questions, I just want to needle a little bit more into that. What does it mean when that relationship is terminated legally? And what does it mean to reestablish that? Because I think we need to make sure we understand what that impact will be.
Thank you. And so, Representative Mina, what I would say is that what I would like to do is figure out how we amend this bill to accomplish the goal of the former foster kids, but minimize the legal and potentially administrative headaches that we might, to try to see how can we do this without causing extra hearings, without causing extra work for OCS, to minimize that burden. And I think that there are some potential ways of tweaking the bill to perhaps lessen some of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Castillo.
Thank you. So to the sponsor, it seems to me that the intent of the bill and the analysis provided in the fiscal note are not, they don't jive. And so because the fiscal note becomes a part of the document, I might suggest that we work to try to get a different explanation in the fiscal note so that it doesn't become confusing if this bill were to pass.
Through the chair, Representative Castillo, I agree. Thank you. If it's okay, Vice Chair Kopp, can we go to public testimony, and I'll actually come back and take the.
Thank you, Rosie. Yes, seeing no more questions from the committee, we will now take up public testimony. Public testimony on House Bill 57 is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Okay, seeing and hearing none. Is there anyone online that would like to testify?
Anna Redman, if you could take yourself off mute, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Anna Redman. Sorry, I'm not sure how to like formally introduce myself.
You've done a great job. Begin your testimony.
My name is Anna Redman, and I am from Anchorage. I am calling in today to testify in support of House Bill 157 and to discuss something deeply important to me. which is sibling relationships, but more specifically, the legality and preservation of sibling relationships post-adoption. When a child or youth is in foster care or adopted, they have already experienced instability, separation, and trauma. For many like myself, sibling relationships are often the longest lasting relationships and connections to their culture, history, identity, and shared memories. Additionally, research shows maintaining sibling relationships improves emotional regulation, long-term mental health outcomes, placement stability, and a child or youth's sense of belonging. When siblings are separated, whether through legal adoption or foster care, it can create an additional sense of grief. Although only one of my 12 siblings was legally adopted, I have maintained a healthy relationship with fewer than half of them. This is the quiet reality that reflects something we don't talk about enough, and that is that sibling relationships are extremely fragile, and once broken, are hard to rebuild. One of my siblings is my best friend, my biggest supporter, and the only one who knows and understands my story without any explanation. This relationship has been a lifeline. It is proof of what happens when connections survive. I also lost a sibling to the system. My 15-year-old brother, JJ, died in his foster home about 5.5 years ago. I will always carry the weight of knowing that the system separated us and the lack of consistent sibling connection and support may have contributed to his death. When siblings are separated, we lose not only just contact, but protection, advocacy, and presence. Adoption should create stability, not the opposite. Preserving these relationships does not weaken adoptive families. It strengthens children. Stability can be provided without severing relationships. From someone who has lived this system as a child, a youth, and a caregiver, I urge you to support House Bill 157, and I urge you to protect sibling bonds. They are foundational, not optional. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony today, Ms. Redman. Good job. Seeing no other folks in the room or online to testify, public testimony on House Bill 157 is now closed. I think before we set an amendment deadline on this bill, we need to hear from the invited testimony. I'm hoping that'll be next week. So we'll hold off on setting an amendment deadline. We will now set House Bill 157 aside and bring it up at a later date. Our next item of business is HDR 28, Support Kids Online Safety Act, sponsored by Representative Eichscheid. I would note for the record that I set an amendment deadline of Tuesday, April 7th, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. at the last hearing, and no amendments were received. At this time, I would like to invite the sponsor, Representative Eichscheid, and his staff, Michael Busey, to the witness table. Representative Eichscheid, or Mr. Busey, do you have any final comments on this resolution before we proceed?
Yes, thank you, Chair Gray. Representative Ted Eichscheid, for the record, I represent Northeast Anchorage, North Muldoon, otherwise known as House District 22. Yes, the resolution is urging Congress to pass the Kids Online Safety Act. It essentially is a bipartisan effort to protect our children, and it's had a lot of vetting in the Congress. It's around its second time around. It's had some changes to improve it, and based on a lot of the discussions we've had over the last 2 years, this is congruent with many of the interests we have here in Alaska to protect our children from online harm.
Thank you, Representative Eichscheid. Are there any questions from committee members for the sponsor? Representative Costello.
Thank you. And thank you. I don't know if the sponsor knows this, but it's come up in some conversations. When do we find out that when resolutions passed that they actually were sent? I noticed this one goes to all the members of Congress, but do we have a process that you're aware of where we know that resolutions that we passed are actually sent on to those that are supposed to receive copies?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, I don't have a definitive answer on that. I know Representative Holland has been working on this issue. I'll let others make comments on it, but there seems to be some question about when resolutions that are passed are actually forwarded. And, of course, that is an area of potential concern. So I do not know for a detailed answer to that. Perhaps someone else on the committee does.
If I may, Mr. Chairman. So, I mean, it's a great question Representative Costello asked, and there is a considerable consternation among many legislative offices that when resolutions do pass the entire body, they're not automatically transmitted to wherever they need to go. And it is an area, if that was your question, it is an area that we're looking at to see if we can shore up a procedural process that everybody agrees on, that once they're transmitted by the chief clerk of either body, that there's an agreed upon, this will go to Congress, this will go. We had some resolutions this last year that didn't move for like 6 months after we passed them. And I don't think that it was an intentional thing. It was just like, but the process needs to be fine-tuned. Yeah.
Any other questions for the sponsor? Representative Mina.
I guess just to follow up through the chair to Representative Eichscheid from the last hearing. So I understand that the Kids Online Safety Act legislation has changed a lot over the past different iterations, and there were different duty of care provisions in the past. People talked about age verification, but right now the bill seems like it's more generic, it's more content neutral, and it's just more specific about regulating algorithms for minors. Is that correct?
Yes, through the chair, and I'll ask my staffer to add some nuance to this. But yeah, there were some concerns about the first iteration of the bill, and those concerns were addressed in a second iteration. But I'll let my staffer introduce himself and add some nuance to that.
Thank you, Michael Busey, staff to Representative Eichscheid through the chair. Thank you, Rep. Mina, for that question. And one of the changes to the original bill as it was introduced in 2022, I think, it was a very specific carve out that there would not be that this bill should not affect the ability for people to access content, and that the focus would be on the design features of social media platforms that were causing harm. And actually, if it'd be all right, I had one point to add to Representative Costello's question or comment, and that's that the 119th Congress will end in January of 2027. So if it gets there after that, it doesn't do much good.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, can I have a motion?
Yes. Yeah. Mr. Chair, at this time I move that House Joint Resolution 28, Work Order 34-LS1271/A be reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, House Joint Resolution 28, Work Order 34-LS1271/A as an alpha, is reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. I authorize Legislative Legal to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. We will take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Our final item of business today is HB 74, Crime Counterfeit Non-Functioning Airbag, sponsored by Representative Tomaszewski. At this time, I would invite the sponsor, staff, David Goff, to the witness table. At ease. Is he able to? Back on the record with Mr. Goff. As a reminder, at our last hearing, we had proposed a committee substitute on the table for discussion. I would like to begin by withdrawing the committee substitute. For the record, that means the version under discussion is the original bill as it came into committee, Work Order 34-LS0455/A. At our last hearing, I also set an amendment deadline of Wednesday, March 25th, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Our office received two amendments. We will now take up Amendment 1. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Amendment 1.
I will object for purposes of discussion.
For the sake of being transparent, it's version 34-LS0455/A.14. So what this amendment does is that it makes it illegal to install or manufacture a defective airbag, simplifying the bill so that it's just clear that these are the two activities that would be illegal.
Thank you, Representative Costello. And my staff had actually, is it okay if I just read a sentence that says, the amendment narrows the crime of airbag fraud so that it only covers the knowing installation, reinstallation, or manufacture of a counterfeit or non-functioning airbag or an airbag that does not comply with the safety regulations for that vehicle. It removes the definition of recalled because it's no longer relevant, and it makes various technical and conforming changes. Are there any questions on Amendment Number 1? Does the sponsor have a comment on Amendment 1?
No. For the record, this is David Goff, staff to Representative Tomaszewski. No, we have no comment. Amendment Number 1.
I will withdraw my objection. Are there any other objections? Seeing no objection, Amendment 1 has been adopted. We will now turn to Amendment 2, although in light of the adoption of Amendment 1, does the maker still wish to offer Amendment 2?
I will not be offering Amendment 2.
Thank you. Are there any final questions or comments from the committee on HB 74? Seeing no further questions or comments, do we have a motion at this time?
Mr. Chair, at this time I move that House Bill 74, Work Order 34-LS0455/A, as amended, be reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
House Bill, hearing no objection, House Bill 74, Work Order 34-LS0455/A is reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes as amended. I authorize Legislative Legal Services to make any and all necessary technical and conforming changes. We will sign this paperwork after this meeting is adjourned. I ask you to remain around. That concludes today's business before the committee. Before we adjourn, I would like to remind everyone that we will not be meeting this Friday, April 17th. The time is now 2:19 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.